The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to the Smart Driving Cars Podcast. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with the Faculty Chair of Autonomous Vehicle Engineering at Princeton University, Alan Kornhauser. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Fred. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. Getting our appetite ready for Thanksgiving. We have another great guest joining us today, Richard Mudge, Dick Mudge, President of Compass Transportation and Technology, and a co-author of Alan's of a new report titled Market Framework and Outlook for Automated Vehicle Systems. Thanks for joining us, Dick.
Fine, looking forward to it.
To quote from the summary conclusions in the report, advanced vehicle automation is coming soon, sooner than those outside the industry generally expect, and the impact of these changes will be unprecedented. Dick, first of all, give us a little background and context about this report.
If you're in the consulting business, the key to success is to have a good client. And in this case, we did have a good client. Al and I did. The Society of Actuaries are basically the brains behind the insurance industry. This is a group that has limited experience with autonomous vehicles, has strong reasons to be very interested in autonomous vehicles. They are a knowledgeable group. So it's fun preparing something for them because they're whatever we provide, they may actually do something with it. And I think our approach to this was different than some of the traditional studies. The title says it all. We're going to take a market approach to it. We're not going to be worrying about different levels in SAE, and we're providing a framework. So it's something people and they can react to and use as the world changes. Rather than providing definitive forecasts of things.
Alan, a little more about the goal of this report.
Well, the goal of this report was really to inform the insurance industry through the actuaries, who are actually the ones that are monitoring what the implications of all this technology are. And in that monitoring process really end up setting what the insurance rates are and so on. And it's important that since they're really looking at what the output of the technology is as opposed to the technology itself, it's key that we provided them with a business view.
And we've talked before, Alan, about the impact on the insurance industry. And your thinking has been that the insurance industry is going to be one of the drivers making all of this happen, that they have some real incentive here.
Well, that's the perspective that I've taken on this. The insurance industry can help make this happen. Why? Because they are a key player in the process, and especially with respect to individuals and certain types of this technology. And so I think it was important for us to really bring that perspective to them simply because they can help and if they really want to go out there and do that. And I guess that was part of our motivation in doing this study.
You know, a lot of the stuff on autonomous vehicles gets way down in the weeds about what does each level mean, what exactly is happening, when and where. We were able to provide a broader market framework, and then go through and say, what do we know today? What don't we know? And how will we be able to figure out how fast this is going to happen? So the report, again, has a different market framework. People who have heard Alan before have heard him talk about safe, self-driving, and driverless categories. And we build the report off of thinking about those things. Each one of them affects the insurance industry in a different way. And it's important for them to be able to focus on those.
What can we tell our audience about the content here? Can you dig into it a bit?
Yeah, let me say one thing we did in it that was a little different. It's fun to do forecasts, but there's no Nobel Prize given if you get the forecast right. So we have not done that. We focused on the data that's out there that's needed. What type of data do you need to analyze safe vehicles versus driverless? We also discuss trigger points. Everybody likes to do scenarios now, and that's again, another fun sport. But in there, we have about 10 different things to track that will help tell people are autonomous vehicles coming faster or slower. And that involves everything from regulations to costs to deployment. I think it's a different way of thinking about this. We also have a section at the end that says, here's what we think we know. And it's very short but very clear about where we think we are within the industry. And I think that will be useful to people, hopefully within the actuaries, because they're the ones who paid us. But I think it has value for broader groups as well.
Yes, I think one of the things that I think we helped them with is to actually focus on the various markets that they will operate in and how different each of those markets are and what they need to focus on. With respect to, and I've said this with respect to sort of my classifications of safe self and driverless, they're very different. You know, the safe driving car is all about improving safety, and that means no collisions. It doesn't have anything to do about comfort, convenience, taking your hands off the wheel or anything like that. And so when they look at the technologies, and then they should focus on that, and then they can assess it and price it and move forward on it in that particular way. Whereas with the self-driving vehicles, it being focused on comfort and convenience, it can then take a different approach and really look at those aspects as it affects its business interests in terms of providing insurance to the industry. And then when you get to the driverless piece where you don't have anybody in it, where it has to operate by itself and go through, say, all those landmines, how to approach that, and especially with respect to the implications that's going to be a fleet business rather than a personal ownership and personal liability reason, makes all the difference in the world, I believe, in terms of the way the insurance industries and actuaries look at that market aspect of this technology. So I think that this is what Dick and I had in mind with this, and I think we at least moved the ball forward.
Yeah, one of the things we talk about a fair amount is data. You know, actuaries are very analytical people, and they analyze things by looking at existing data. And here we have an industry that has almost no existing data. A lot of the data that's out there is wrong and over-promoted. So we have some discussion in there about what can be done to improve the quality of the data, especially around safe vehicles. I think we have a table in there that shows there are 26 different definitions of automatic braking by all the different car companies, which is confusing by itself. And each one has a different level of performance. So to move forward within the industry and within the actuaries, we need to collect better data, and it needs to be timely data. And so that's something which hopefully we can help move the ball forward.
But it sounds like there may be a need for more standardization.
Yes. And then we talked some about regulation, but I think a lot of the standardization could come from the insurance industry. They are logical people to lead this. They need the data now. They need to have better data in it out there right now. The insurance industry can help move that forward.
And it's involved in their definitions of various aspects of this. And they need to have that well defined, and the industry has to know which one of those buckets they are going to fall into. And so, in a sense, the standardization can be led by the insurance industry saying, okay, we're going to have this bucket, but we want you to then meet these specifications and these requirements, and then you're in this particular bucket. So, in fact, they can probably do it more easily than some legislators in various levels of government.
my assumption is that they're really looking forward to being able to get a hold of all of the accident data that these vehicles are going to be producing once they are out on the road in great numbers.
Getting that data very quickly is important, and getting it promoted within the industry is very important. And I will say, I think the Society of Actuaries has been enthusiastic about this. We had a panel to review it. We had an expert panel in addition to go over this. There's been a lot of enthusiasm and interest in learning more about the autonomous vehicle industry and what actuaries and insurance companies can do about it. So it was a very encouraging project to be involved in. And obviously I have a biased view of it, but I think there's some things in there that are said more clearly and more directly than I've seen elsewhere.
And with the conclusion, the summary conclusion saying that advanced vehicle automation is coming sooner than those outside the industry generally expect, someone reading that from outside the industry might wonder, what do you mean? When?
Well, it depends on which one one's looking at, because certainly within the safe driving technology, there are things out there. The problem is that there's a whole range of those technologies out there with a range of different capabilities. And one can begin right now to make sure that they're appropriately classified so that one doesn't have data about one thing and tries to apply it to something else in which it's not really in the same category. So an enormous amount of this exists. It is coming out there. And so there is a lot that can be done today. And with respect to the other things, we're waiting to hear word about whether or not Waymo is actually going to put driverless into operation on a revenue basis before the end of the year. We only have 5 or 6 weeks to go, so let's see.
Well, that is among the stories we want to get to. We've talked about Waymo before, and apparently it's going to happen in days or weeks. Waymo launching its commercial autonomous transportation service in Arizona. This week, the CEO of Volkswagen gave an estimate that the company is 1 or 2 years behind Waymo. Alan, in the latest Smart Driving Cars newsletter, you say they may be further behind than that.
Well, I think so, because driverless is a different business than self-driving, than what the automobile industry has been in. You know, they've been in to sell hardware that you drive and you provide your own mobility. The driverless is a mobility machine, and it's a mobility machine that goes out and provides rides. This is not the business that Volkswagen has been in. And first of all, they have to have that mindset. And the mindset to actually put vehicles out there without anybody in it, as we'll probably discuss with respect to the findings on Uber that have come out, one sees that one needs a very different mindset if one is going to compete in this business. So, yes, I don't know what they mean by autonomous vehicles when they talk about them, but if they're talking about doing Waymo, which Waymo is building a mobility machine that, sure, in the beginning, it's going to have attendants on board to oversee and make sure and keep everybody comfortable. But my understanding is that the entire design of that vehicle, the testing of that vehicle, has been focused on having it work and tested and demonstrated in an environment in which there is no attendant in that vehicle. And to get to be in that mentality and takes a substantial amount of time, and then to then develop the technology from that mentality takes another substantial amount of time, which to me adds up to more than 2 years.
And obviously it's a completely different business model.
Absolutely.
Uber is in the news again. Business Insider reports Uber insiders describe infighting and questionable decisions before its self-driving car killed a pedestrian. What, if anything, are we seeing here that is new?
Well, this is divulging some of the things that we had already known, that in fact, Uber explicitly turned off the emergency braking system that is stock in the Volvos that they were using. Why? Because they were afraid of it intervening and causing an uncomfortable ride. Why? Because they aren't able to determine whether or not a stationary object ahead, you can pass under it or not pass under it. And so looks like I got cut off.
You're still here, Alan. Gee. Keep going.
Okay, let me, you'll be able to fit, whether they could determine whether or not they could pass under the object or not under the object, or whether it was really that stationary object was really in the road ahead. And this causes the automated emergency braking system to trigger if they do that. And so to avoid that, they turned it off. And what this Business Insider does is it gives us more of the information as to what was going on inside of Uber. And the problem was that they were building a vehicle that was requiring an attendant on board. They weren't building a driverless vehicle. They were building a self-driving vehicle, and they marketing it out there or promoting it or who knows what, telling their CEO that they were producing a driverless vehicle. A self-driving vehicle to Uber is essentially worthless, except for maybe, you know, some promotional ramifications, but otherwise it doesn't help their, it's not going to give them their valuation. They need a driverless vehicle. And for them to be able to do that, they have to be designing it as a driverless vehicle from the ground up. They have to have the mentality on the design team that, in fact, there is no attendant on board. And they have to make it perform as with respect to that strong constraint that there is no attendant on board. And apparently they're cutting corners and trying to impress the boss and who knows what else, you know, building a self-driving vehicle as opposed to a driverless vehicle. And so it's that mentality that I think got them into some amount of trouble and basically led to the situation that they ran into in Arizona. So it's a very interesting reading, and it points out the fact that to create this mobility machine requires a very serious development effort focused on having it work completely by itself. And that has to be the overarching direction of the effort, and it has to be able to do that safely. And so thinking that, in fact, oh my goodness, we'll have somebody in there to take over in these situations that we haven't been able to operate in is just wrong, and can't lead to a successful end. Sure, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Sure, there are a lot of conditions in which, oh my goodness, we don't know how to solve this one yet. But all those have to be approached with the mentality that, in fact, it's the system that's going to have to be able to do those things. Else, we're not going to operate in that domain.
You know, there may be some confusion among some listeners wondering, what do you mean? What's the difference between a self-driving car or vehicle and driverless? And I guess the explanation is simple. One is a self-driving is sort of like a cruise control on steroids, and a driverless means it can really go without anybody behind the wheel.
Well, I wouldn't even say that. It's way more than cruise control on steroids. It's going into an elevator without an elevator operator and it working. Okay. The reference to self-driving is that, in fact, there's somebody overlooking what is going on and taking over if something should go wrong and saving the day. Well, you can't run into those situations that you need a person to take over and save the day. it has to operate in an environment in which there is no vehicle. So in an elevator, and I always love to use the elevator analogy, okay, I have an elevator shaft and so on, and therefore, I guess not much can happen, and therefore we don't need the elevator operator, and everybody's nice and comfortable with that. Good. Now we have to make the system in both in terms of the artificial intelligence and everything else with respect to these vehicles. If they're going to go out on our roads, they're going to have to basically be able to recognize that the road edges are just like an elevator shaft, and that in fact, if there's anything ahead, it's going to have to stop, and it's going to have to make sure it doesn't get rear-ended in that process, and so on and so forth. But it's going to have to do it. Not, oh my goodness, it gets into a difficult situation and some superhuman individual is not going to come in and take over. No, that's not it. And one shouldn't go out there and try to demonstrate these operations to a CEO and sort of say, hey, we're going to make it seem like it's actually can operate everywhere, but we're going to constrain it so much that he or she won't recognize the difference, and therefore we're going to be able to put the wool over the CEO's eyes and become heroes and get big bonuses. Oh my goodness, that's ugly. That's ugly.
Dick, what's been your experience with clients, et cetera? Is there a pretty good understanding of what the difference is here when we talk about things like self-driving?
I think there's tremendous confusion. I think everybody thinks when they use the phrase self-driving or driverless that they're both the same. And I think people don't understand the fundamental differences about the impacts on driving and the impacts on society. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done.
I'm glad you're helping to do it.
I think there's tremendous confusion. I think everybody thinks when they use the phrase self-driving or driverless, that they're both the same. I think people don't understand the fundamental differences about the impacts on driving and the impacts on society. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done.
I'm glad you're helping to do it.
Absolutely, Dick. You're absolutely right on that. It is so obvious. And I think that the road that Waymo has been on since 2009 has been one in which, you know, I know Chris, when he was there, was always promoting, we are going to do this without a person in it. And it's having that mindset to do it that way, from the beginning, that has allowed them to get to where they are. It can't be, oh, yeah, we're going to look, be like Tesla, you know, the driver can take over. And then all of a sudden, we can put these things out there to just move people around. I don't think that is a successful means to that end.
Yeah, I think there's a general sloppiness in terminology, and that's mostly, a lot of it's due to the press, who is not careful about it, but I think even people in the industry are not careful about it. So we have about four or five phrases that we use that people think they mean the same thing, and they do not.
Another story to get to, GM's Cruise, in the meantime, is planning to set up offices in Seattle and hire as many as 200 engineers there by the end of next year.
Well, I think that's interesting. And I guess, you know, Cruise is going out there to where people are to work on this, and where the startup folks and all of my students are not working or something like that to try to hire them. But it seems, I don't know, at some point this industry has to mature a little bit and recognize that, in fact, this isn't a hackathon that's going to produce this thing. It's a lot of very hard, continuous, dedicated work to finally get this so that it works and it works safely. And to make that happen is going to require dedicated people that aren't just bouncing from one company to the next to get their next bonus. So I don't know. I think this industry has to mature a little bit. And, okay, it's nice that that GM Cruise is going to go to Seattle, where there are some of these so-called whiz kids, or I don't know what the heck they're called today, but whatever. But at some point, one's going to have to bear down with some hard workers who are going to work hard for a substantial amount of time to get this thing really working.
And off a little bit on a tangent here, the New York Times a couple of days ago ran a story with the headline, "The American Dream is Alive in China." And it talks about optimism in that country. And that's a story that really caught your eye, Alan.
Yeah, it caught my eye because it's almost to the day 40 years since I first went to China, and the enormous change in China, as everybody realizes, it's unbelievable. And when you look at, I'll say, an enormous improvement in the quality of life of at least 800 million people, you know, that's a non-trivial accomplishment. And kudos to them. I mean, yes, there may have been, you know, some political issues over the past 40 years, but my goodness, they've really accomplished something. And it's nice to see the article. Unfortunately, we now may be number two in the world, but so be it.
And then there was a story about Michael Bloomberg, also in the Times, one of my bosses a decade or so ago, who's giving $1.8 billion to Johns Hopkins University to be used for financial aid for low and moderate income students.
Well, kudos to him again. I mean, you know, what's nice about the billionaires that have been created through communications and technology and so on is that they're giving most of their money away. And this is a wonderful way for Michael to give his money away. And I guess I have a little footnote in there in terms of what I would like to see Princeton do with respect to those things. People can take a look at smart driving cars at that. Nobody else tends to agree with me on it. But in a sense, having the endowment that Princeton has, really, it should just make undergraduate education free for those who Princeton has chosen to admit, asking a middle class family to contribute a little bit amount of money is just putting them in a just unfair situation, because that's their child probably is so darn good. They've gotten a free ride from very good other university, and now they have to choose between a free ride at a very good other university versus having to pay a little bit to Princeton. Doesn't seem to me that it's worth collecting that money. But anyway, very few people agree with me on that also. So, but it was very nice to basically be able to go recruit a class, and that's, I think, would make everybody so much better off. The peers, students that would be there would be just phenomenal. But anyway, just another view.
And you're not running for office, as far as we know.
Right.
And finally, from the half-baked section of the newsletter, there's a headline, "Police can remotely drive your stolen Tesla into custody."
Great, wonderful that the police can do that. I mean, anybody who's going to use a Tesla to do any of that knows how to disconnect the Tesla's automated systems so that the first thing that they'll do is they'll disable that capability. And guess what? The police won't be able to do it. I know when they stole my car from the front of my house, what's the first thing they did? They disabled all those tracking capabilities and everything else, because I guess, you know, they're one step ahead of us on the technology end. So, yes, maybe that's a nice thing to think about for the police, but probably not going to happen.
Well, that is it for this edition. We want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in and wish them a happy Thanksgiving. And we want to thank Dick Mudge for coming along for the ride with us this week. Thanks, Dick.
You're welcome. I want to make sure I mention our co-author was Matt Hardison, who is now with Washington Metropolitan Transportation Authority.
It was great to have Matt involved.
You can find us at smartdrivingcar.com, now on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Spreaker, and more. You can ask your smart speaker to play us too. You can find my tech reports at textination.com. I'm Fred Fishkin, along with Alan Kornhauser. Thanks for tuning in, and have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, wah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The iPhone XR is here at T-Mobile, and there's a whole lot to love. Like taking those perfect new year, new you portrait mode selfies you're going to share.
Nice.
It's the best way to stay connected to everyone you'll heart most in 2019. So get ready to fall in love with iPhone XR on T-Mobile, the most loved in wireless. Call 1-800-T-MOBILE to learn more or visit a store today.